Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Ah, we hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show. It is November 8th we're doing this. It finally feels like fall here in the New York tri-state area. It's pretty great. How you doing, Dean?
I'm good. I'm ready for blast off here. We're going to do something close to our hearts today, right? And talk about space exploration a little bit.
Yep. What is that sound?
That sound is the sound of a Delta IV rocket carrying its payload from our wee blue marble to somewhere out there, that-a-way. According to the manufacturer, Boeing, the Delta IV launch vehicles can accommodate single or multiple payloads on the same mission. The rockets can launch payloads too, and when I read this list of specs, I thought, well, this is time to dust off your eighth grade science class reader list. Polar orbits, sun-synchronous orbits, geosynchronous orbits, and geosynchronous transfer orbits, and also low Earth orbit. I only got a 95 on that quiz, I guess.
Yeah, well, you get to serve on the Farragut now instead of the Enterprise. Well done.
Oh, come on! I hate that design, the Miranda class. It's probably not that. We're going to get hate mail. I think it's
Miranda. Good, send it. They sound awesome. This Delta IV audio is just one of like 63 or so clips that NASA released in the past couple of weeks. It's cool that they drop these in our laps every now and again. It's a lot of space stuff, launch pad stuff, and there's some audio which is clearly alien life that they, of course, would have us believe is electromagnetic noise caused by plasma waves in Earth's radiation belt. And I say hooey. Give a listen.
X-1.
It totally sounds like that.
Now, when you say they are covering this up, I know who you mean, and you're afraid to say it because you're afraid that they are listening. Now, tell us who they is. Who's they that's keeping the alien life secret?
Hollywood's Van Patten family.
Oh, God, you said it. You really? I'm going to edit that out.
Why?
It's obviously not the Van Pattens. Always with the Van Pattens.
Well, I mean, they're an easy scapegoat. Who is it? Who is keeping this from us, Dean? Who is trying to fleece the American people?
Certainly not the Van Pattens. Maybe that one daughter. She always looked a little bit squirrely on Eight is Enough.
Yeah.
What did happen to his wife? I mean, they never explored that.
No, they didn't. Same thing that happened to Carol Brady's wife and Mr. Brady's or husband and wife. They weren't that modern a family. I don't know what the hell happened to those people. Yeah. But anyway, here's some more space sounds. This is supposedly what a lightning sounds like on Jupiter. Give it a listen. That doesn't sound like lightning to me. That sounds like some kids setting off bottle rockets. But what do I know?
Well, it's one of those things where the atmosphere changes so much. And that's one of those things about space that always with the movies that we were talking about where there's all these noises. And they had to tell you that in science class. You'd always get one teacher that would tell you, in space there actually would be no sound. And they were like, no, that's not true. I've heard phasers many times. And then,
exactly.
And then Alien had to come out with the tagline that said, in space, nobody can hear you scream.
Yep.
And of course, that was, and I, at least as a kid, I clung to, well, they never send a Greek astronaut into space. And I'm pretty sure you could hear one of them scream. But the Russian cosmonaut, they did eventually send an ethnic Greek guy into space, and I don't think they could hear even him scream. So the vacuum of space is soundless.
It is. And we'll get into that in a little while, how that even that sort of perverted some of our early thoughts about what space was and what it could be. And we had a bunch of, effects guys who filled our heads with wonderful sounds. And of course, there was one film director who was having none of it. We'll get back to that in a little while.
We obviously talk about space a lot in exploration and the science fiction angle. But two events of the past couple of weeks have gotten us thinking about space in a certain context. On October 28th, a commercial rocket failed and exploded seconds after liftoff. The Antares rocket was consumed in a massive fireball just after its 6:22 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time launch from NASA's Wallops Flight facility on Wallops Island, Virginia. The rocket was carrying an unmanned Cygnus spacecraft that was packed with about 2.5 tons of supplies for astronauts on the International Space Station. But it's worth noting, before you have visions of, you know, space cannibalism, that right.
I have those a lot, by the way.
Well, you know, we were kids. It was like, right, they would always put space in front of things to try to make it sound scarier. Let me get you to buy cereal. I don't want to eat that cereal, but it's space cereal. Okay.
And now you have this space ice cream.
Mikey likes it. Well, now they do that with smart. It drives me crazy. Oh, yeah. Oh, I wouldn't want to get in that little lawnmower with an engine. It's a smart car. Well, okay, let's drive it. I couldn't even, you know, my knees would not even fit in that thing.
No, and then it's going to be maximum overdrive, and they're going to become sentient, and they're going to destroy everybody. And it's going to be a big truck with Green Goblin's face on it.
So they didn't need the food, and they didn't need the supplies. So it was just a very expensive, failed trip to the grocery store for them.
Right, exactly. And days later, and this has had much more tragic results, another private spacecraft, this is Richard Branson, and his Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 blew apart seconds after separating from its carrier plane during a midair launch tens of thousands of feet above the Mojave Desert. The pilot found dead in the wreckage was identified by Kern County Coroner's Office as 39-year-old Michael Owlsbury. He was an experienced pilot for the aerospace firm Scaled Composites. The surviving pilot, who parachuted to the ground severely injured, was identified by the Kern County Sheriff as Peter Sebald, and he was alert a couple days after and talked with his family and doctors, according to a statement by Scaled Composites.
That's really amazing that he parachuted. You've gone parachuting. I have not. And you've had a midair, whatever you would, I guess, FUBAR in the space term. Yeah. I guess
you might want to call it a mishap.
Yeah. So, and so the idea that he has only seconds to think of all this, and there's very thin air up there. He has to worry about going unconscious before he can, you know, pull the chute and get out and survive such a huge drop. I mean, it's the opening of the $6 million man, except that we can't really rebuild much. So it's amazing that he was able to survive this incredible fall. He's 43 years old. The other pilot that we lost, only 38.
39.
So that's just tragic. And I can't imagine. I mean, 43, you're old enough to be much more afraid than you would be at, say, 22 or 24 or 25.
Right.
So
if you have any brains in the caveman head of yours, you definitely are more afraid. And again, not knowing the specifics and not knowing what the man's experience up there was, you know, you think about what is the difference between life and death. And, you know, don't want to get into thoughts about, you know, why Mr. Owlsbury died and Mr. Sebald didn't. But I know for sure when you're in a situation like that, when you are high above the earth and things do go wrong, adrenaline is your best friend. And I wonder and I hope that the adrenalized response is what helped Mr. Sebald get down. I don't know, frightening either way. But what it brings us to is this idea, and you've heard this sort of chorus of voices over the past couple of weeks, you know, lamenting. People don't like anything to work these days, it seems. You know, people just like to take their time to take shots at stuff and, you know, oh, well, this is going to be the end of, you know, private space, you know, or we shouldn't be doing this, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, it's just too dangerous. And that sort of makes me sick to my stomach, the idea of it. I don't know why people seem to be losing faith in adventure and risk. It seems like they are. If you listen to the chorus of knuckleheads in the noise machine, which is what we frequently reference.
Yeah, there's so many people that do take these risks, and they don't take them for, I mean, this isn't those Jackass movies. It's not just for, you know, it's not even, you know, as cool as we all thought Evel Knievel was. That was for entertainment. Right. And this is really to push forward the frontiers of human life and the human experience, and to try to get into space. And there's kind of a void right now where we're not flying into space as the United States anymore with NASA. And people do want this. There's a market for it. But private people want to be able to go into space. And as with everything, be it the digital watch or the plasma screen TV, it eventually comes to everybody. You learn so much. But unfortunately, one of the prices of learning is that sometimes people will lose their lives. They'll catch fire on the launch pad, as we know, or on reentry, or a heat tile will go loose. But that's the price of it. And it makes you just feel so weak, as we've also are wont to say about, you're afraid of a little turbulence in a plane. Never mind getting up in this, you know, strapping a giant rocket full of flammable fuel, onto your back and just rocketing up there into nothing and not knowing what you're going to get.
That's right. That's right. And you did reference this, you know, this idea of the U.S. really not having a robust space presence, at least not the one that man, not the one that we were sold on as kids, you know. Even by the time, you know, you and I were younger in this and were coming up in the 70s, you know, things had stopped and things had begun to sort of peter out in terms of the great excitement and all the patriotic fervor that extended beyond our borders to hopefully help, you know, the entire planet that President Kennedy got us off on the right foot on, you know. And what, we stopped making moon landings, what was it, 74 or so? I'm sure someone will correct us. But it's, and then from there, we had the shuttle program, and that's gone. And now we don't have much, you know. And yeah. So it's going to fall to these private organizations to keep it alive. Man, I hope to hell they do. I want what I want. I want Star Trek, let's be honest. but in a realistic sense, I want us to continue to strive. I want us to continue to push. I want us to continue to use all of our technological might toward this thing, which is great, which is actually not, you know, we need something beyond being able to, you know, perfect the drone, you know?
It's like Buzz Aldrin on MIT Technology Review's November 2012 cover, quote, "You promised me Mars colonies. Instead, I got Facebook."
Exactly.
You referenced JFK's speech, and I'd written that in the margins here. When people ask why do we need to go to space?
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
You know, that's why we want to go into space, and that's the answer to it. You know, you need something to strive for. There was a poster with a Robert Browning quote in my science class, as it happens, and mm-hmm. later my physics class, and I also had a homeroom there, and I stared at it for all those periods in high school being bored some of the time, and it was a Robert Browning quote that said, "Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp." You've probably seen it a million times on posters.
That's right.
Or else what's a heaven for? And I could not figure it out. I guess I just wasn't really concentrating. You never know that I was going to grow up to be a writer someday. I couldn't get the nuance of what the heck. I think I was just annoyed with the teacher or something. But anyway, but it really is true, is that you need something to really strive and reach for. Because if you don't, not only will people not have something to compare it to when they want to whine that we could put a man on the moon, but we can't. There's something
right.
There's something very aspirational about that. There's something about saying, hey, you know, see that thing up there? We walked on that, and yet
we went there.
What can't we do if we can freaking do that?
Exactly. You know, that Browning quote and that poster, I never got that far because I was always hung up on the today is the first day of the rest of your life poster that had a picture of the stream and the mountain lake, and I just couldn't understand that. So I was just like, wait a second, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And I'm like, but what about tomorrow? What about yesterday? So yeah, I never got as far as the Browning poster because I got hung up there.
Little
then
too
they
literal.
Put me in a special room.
A little too literal. And do you know that hang in there kitten? 37 years old today.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Hang in there, kitten.
Never would just refuse to, yeah, through all the dialysis and the glaucoma and the mange and the, you know,
exactly.
All, yeah, sure, lost an ear in a cockfight, and yet
it's
that
a terrible
kitten
thing.
Still hanging down that branch, refusing to give up. That's
refusing
what space is all about.
It is. See, thanks. Hey, we'll see you next time. We don't need to say anything else. It's great.
And, one more thing about the private space industry. We need it because in this timeline, if we don't have private space exploration, we'll never have Zefram Cochrane. We'll never get
exactly
warp drive,
right.
And we'll never make first contact with the Vulcans. That's
nope.
all.
Nope, exactly right. Exactly right. Well, let's see. What is this, 2014? And, well, Khan has been in cryo freeze for a while now, so I don't know who's running things down here on Earth, but it was Khan during the 90s when we had some of our last great space achievements. But anyway, hey, listen, when we were talking about doing this show and we were talking about this risk notion, and there's something that always fascinates us. You know, there are these big events that happen. You know, Eisenhower had another speech that he could have read about D-Day. It was written, it was ready to go. There was a statement about Apollo 11, which got our guys on the moon 45 years ago this past July. Why don't you fill us in a bit about that and set up that soundbite, Dean?
It wasn't that they were taking these risks thinking it was definitely going to happen. This was an amazing thing. They didn't know. You can only research so much. They didn't know. You didn't have anybody to go there and check out the landing site and do pre-checks on the soil. They didn't know if they would sink in. They're pretty confident that they wouldn't. But there were so many things, even the landing. I mean, that was only seconds away from going wrong for the Eagle to actually land. And they had to be prepared for President Nixon to read something if in the event that they either crash landed or that they weren't able to get them back. And so William Safire wrote something for the president. He was working for him at the time, later New York Times columnist. And he talked with the late Tim Russert about it on Meet the Press on a future anniversary afterwards. And this is on the internet a lot now, but at the time, it was really amazing that they had this. And just to think about this, what if, what would have happened if we hadn't brought the astronauts back? So here's that soundbite.
Bill Safire, this weekend is so filled with history. 30 years ago, the headline of your paper, the New York Times, Men Walk on Moon. But what has surfaced is a memo from one Bill Safire to H.R. Bob Haldeman, who was then President Nixon's chief of staff. We can put it on the screen. It was called In the Event of Moon Disaster. And it was a draft speech that you wrote that began, fate has ordained that man who went to moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. These brave men, Neil Armstrong, Edwin Aldrin, know that there's no hope for the recovery, but they also know there is hope for mankind in their sacrifice. Tell us about this.
Well, we have a tendency now to just assume that the moonshot, Apollo 11, was an enormous technical feat that exhibited great hope for mankind. I remember when Frank Borman, who was the astronaut who acted as the liaison with the White House, called me up and said, you're working on this moonshot. You want to consider a alternative posture for the president in the event of mishaps. And that was, as far as I was concerned, a gobbledygook, and I didn't get it until he added, and I can hear him now, like what to do for the widows. Because at that time, the most important, the most dangerous part of the moon mission was to get that lunar module back up into orbit around the moon and to join the command ship. But if they couldn't, and it was a good risk that they couldn't, then they would have to be abandoned on the moon, left to die there. And mission control would then have to use their euphemism, close down communication. And the men would have to either starve to death or commit suicide. And so we prepared for that with a speech that I wrote. And the president was ready to give that. And of course, the module made it. And for 17 years after that, we operated on the assumption that there could be nothing wrong in the space program. And then, of course, until the Challenger exploded on television in front of everybody, we realized what enormous risks that were being run by these astronauts. They laid their lives on the line every time. And as we look back to 30 years ago, some will remember Chappaquiddick that weekend. But the headline of Men Walk on Moon, that will be looked at 100 or 1,000 years from now.
I should also note that on the moon is a plaque, here men from the planet Earth first set foot on the moon, July 1969 A.D., we came in peace for all mankind. This was written by Bill Safire. The A.D. should have been before July 69. Author Wordsmith Safire made a big mistake.
Can you imagine the first piece of writing into space contains a grammatical error, and I made it.
Talk about a different world. Because one of the things, again, Star Trek, it really is involved with the space race, and it reflected it. People talk about it being cheesy now, but go back and look at anything in the 60s. Go back at the picture and look at President Nixon in that bowling alley. I mean, the wallpaper,
right.
The shoes, the jacket. It was a cheesy time compared to what we see now, right?
Exactly.
They were not too – after the war and all the misery and the dismalness, like people wanted those bright, crazy colors and the music. And so it was a cheesy show, but it reflected that culture. And when we did land on the moon, that's when they brought Star Trek back. After they weren't sure they were going to bring it back for
that's
another
right, for
season.
And
then William Shatner says, well, with the, we were it then. They said, hey, we want these guys back and to put them in there. So it whether you like Star Trek or not, and I can't imagine many of our listeners don't, it's really reflected something. It's really more than just a cheesy show. It was reflecting what people wanted. They wanted that optimism. You're talking in the middle of the Vietnam War in the United States. You're talking the assassinations we've talked about of Martin Luther King and the Kennedys, and just a lot of misery and lack of optimism. And sci-fi sort of fought that cynicism. And you said, you know, years later, and it was really a vision of the future.
No, absolutely. You know, and like you said, so much going on in our country at the time. And the show itself, just like the space program, was something aspirational. It was a reflection of us at our possible best. A strong, robust military that was guided by a clear set of ideals. Kirk was like the ultimate warrior poet, you know, in a way. And so, yeah, there was so much that a lot of people really hoped that we could get. And man, oh man, oh man, did that influence the way certainly I thought about space and I thought about our future, you know, like a lot of other people. So also, you know, we had the Apollo 11 statement, and there was a real disaster, something that did happen early on in the program. It was the Apollo 1 disaster, AS-204. During a pre-flight test for what was to be the first manned Apollo mission, a fire claimed the lives of three of our astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, Roger Chaffee. After the disaster, the mission was officially designated Apollo 1. You know what? We didn't stop. We didn't stop when those men died.
I don't even remember them having a congressional hearing. Not that I would at the time, but I don't think it was today. Everybody, every single committee that's in any way involved would want to get their finger in and,
of course,
you know, try to ramp up a little bit of funding for quote-unquote safety that would just coincidentally go to their district.
Yeah, funny how that happens.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, back in the 60s, of course, you know, conspiracy theories always float around the outer edges of history, you know, where there's a certain amount of murk or where people, you know, have a set of ideas that, you know, facts be damned. But there were these Italian brothers, the Giudica Cordelia brothers from Turin. There were a couple of radio enthusiasts, and they claimed to have hacked Soviet space program transmissions and picked up audio of cosmonauts dying in space. And that was one of the things that the Iron Curtain sort of generated, was this notion of, we just don't know a lot about what they're doing over there. And we knew that, you know, they were ahead of us in the space program and, you know, America. We don't want to be lapped by them. But these brothers presented audio, which you can maybe hear a little bit in the background now, of supposedly that were cosmonauts who were either A, about to burn up on reentry, you know, this woman cosmonaut, and another one whose craft sort of, I mean, bounced off its orbit or something and kept going out into space, and there was no hope for him. None of this was ever confirmed, but man, was it always out there, and it was tied up in this risk factor, you know? As mysterious and murky as the Soviets were, they were going through a lot of the same things that we were. And to have these two brothers have this audio, it gives something, at least conspiracy theorists, you know, something to chew on. But it says in the greater sense that these stories certainly floated around. They have a basis in shared concern about the risks of spaceflight. And I always found it fascinating. But in 1986, we endured a true space tragedy for the modern age, and it wouldn't be the only space shuttle we lost. It was, you know, January of 1986, and the shuttle Challenger exploded a minute and change after takeoff, and that hit so close to home for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which was our proxy was on there with us, our representative, Krista McAuliffe. You know, she was a civilian, she was a teacher, and we were part of her journey, and the ramped up excitement of all of it, a lot of it we placed on her shoulders because she was us and she was up there. And what was that great speech that Peggy Noonan wrote for President Reagan?
Yes.
The surly bonds of Earth.
And touch the face of God.
Yeah.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista McAuliffe. We mourn their loss as a nation together. To the families of the seven, We cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, give me a challenge, and I'll meet it with joy. They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us. We've grown used to wonders in this century. It's hard to dazzle us. But for 25 years, the United States space program has been doing just that. We've grown used to the idea of space, and perhaps we forget that we've only just begun. We're still pioneers. They, the members of the Challenger crew, were pioneers. And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue. I want to add that I wish I could talk to every man and woman who works for NASA or who worked on this mission and tell them, your dedication and professionalism have moved and impressed us for decades, and we know of your anguish. We share it. There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
If you read her book, What I Saw at the Revolution, or talk to her about it, one of the reasons that was a powerful speech, something I find fascinating, we talk about speeches a lot, is because that needed to be turned around so fast, it didn't have to go through the homogenizing process of the, you know, everybody wants to stick their hand in, State Department wants their thing, NASA wants theirs. And so it was really a direct speech. And that's one reason, you know, she really hit on what he wanted to say. Whereas something like his Berlin Wall speech, he said the State Department people kept taking out tear down this wall because they felt it was too confrontational and it was just too mean. And he turns at one point and he says, they can take it out a million times, I'm still going to say it, you know? So,
Mr. President, could you say, instead of tear down this wall, just remove brick by brick in an orderly, non-confrontational fashion. Would you say that instead?
And it's 25 years ago right now that,
this very day.
That it came down. So yeah, just a few throw pillows around it just to make it a little nicer. Just didn't have this ring that it would have. Maybe put a path, a couple of shrubberies to the path.
Exactly. Maybe put a Keith Haring drawing on it. Although I'm sure they did, actually. The graffiti of those walls, absolutely wild.
And John Glenn also later went back with the space shuttle.
Right.
I wanted to mention, since we were on the space shuttle, a fun thing to do is go look at all those patches. And it's very creative how they always manage to wrap something in there. And they had the usual space shuttle logo, and they had the capsule that had carried John Glenn originally orbiting around it. It was really a fun image. You know, as we said, when you're a kid and you're into space, you're into sci-fi, you love looking at that kind of thing. And that was one of the specials that I worked on. I don't know if you worked on it at Fox, but that was a question too before. I remember them asking the guy that they brought in, especially who had experience covering space launches, and somebody asked him.
Was it John Pike?
Yeah, I learned Morse code.
I for once was not making a Star Trek joke. I thought he was one of the dudes who would have on an ear. Anyway.
Oh, right. It was Christopher Pike. No, I just thought it was, yeah. And speaking of which, that fire, I wonder if that was influenced at all by that Apollo mission, the whole idea.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good, right. If you guys remember in the Star Trek episode, the original episode, Court Martial, Christopher Pike, the original captain of the Enterprise, comes back and he's been terribly, terribly disfigured and wounded in a fire. And that's what Dean's talking about. And that would have been only, you know, what, 60s? Well, that was probably the same year.
Yeah. Could have been. Yeah. I mean, as an example of it. Yeah, he was rescuing a bunch of, I think, cadets and got right. burned in the show. And so that was a scary thing. Talk about scary thing as a child. So, I mean, Star Trek didn't hide that. People died, much as we like to mock the red shirts. Keep in mind, now we watch them all at once. That once every couple of weeks, a guy dying, it wouldn't have been as obvious. A lot of those things in TV shows we notice now because we binge watch, as they call it.
Exactly. But
that was really amazing, John Glenn, and being able to cover that. And somebody asked a PA at the time, well, what if it blows up? Because this was after Challenger and before Columbia. Yeah. And, of course, we had one of those typical producers that doesn't really know anything, but not even TV. But it was like, no, don't say that. How could you? And the guy said, hey, we have to be prepared, I mean, for it. If this happens, and I mean, it's a U.S. senator at this time. It would have been insane if he'd the guy had gone up on national TV. Of course, fortunately, everything went well. And that was when I stepped into the elevator. Another little story there. And Jim Lovell, and I've told you this many times.
I give you credit for telling the story again. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's just a funny one because I don't. I'm known for saying random things in elevators. Right. And just to people.
Like, we're all going
to
die. We're all going to die.
I was the one that gave Norman Lear that idea for the baby to be born in the elevator with Archie. That was my idea. Little four-year-old Dean came up with that.
You're very good.
But anyway, no, I stepped in and he was there with the anchor and I said, Jim Lovell. And then I went, oh, God. No, it's Lovell. And he was a very nice gentleman. He didn't point out that I was an idiot. I was, you went into space and had the whole thing with the rocket. They want a ball. It used to be a problem. Come on.
You're so cool. You almost made it to the moon.
Yeah. Why are you pushing all the buttons? Did you push buttons like this on the... come on, push the button. Look, push it in. There's no 13th floor. You should have looked into that because you were, you know, when you're around somebody, it's only a matter of time usually before they say something, dumber in my case. But, you know, when they'll say something nice, it's usually the first two things. And then Albert Brooks says he always gets away after the second thing because it'll be two things that are nice. And then the third thing will be, yeah, well, that one you did on life in this spin, I didn't really get that one. Like, that wasn't really good, huh? What were you thinking? That was really terrible.
Man?
What is that movie? I'm sorry. I'm going
Shane?
Too far afield. It's about the fear. Defending Your Life.
Defending Your Life. That's one.
I wanted to mention it because it was really good. And you know,
that was a good movie. That was a great movie.
They get around to the CompuSult, as he calls it, eventually.
That's right.
So anyway.
This reminds me, you're talking about meeting Jim Lovell in the elevator. Brian, our friend who you heard on the Alexandria show, he and I, we used to get all these celebrities who would come by the old news channel. And one time, you know, Cheston himself, Charlton Heston, shows up. And we're like, all right, we got to go up and, you know, introduce ourselves to Cheston because he's freaking Charlton Heston.
And that completes my final report until we reach touchdown. We're now on full automatic in the hands of the computers. I've tucked my crew in for the long sleep, and I'll be joining them soon. In less than an hour, we'll finish our sixth month out of Cape Kennedy. 6 months in deep space. By our time, that is. According to Dr. Haslein's theory of time in a vehicle traveling nearly the speed of light, the Earth has aged nearly 700 years since we left it. Well, we've aged hardly at all. Maybe so. This much is probably true. The men who sent us on this journey are long since dead and gone. You who are reading me now are a different breed. I hope a better one. I leave the 20th century with no regrets. But one more thing. If anybody's listening, that is. Nothing scientific. It's purely personal. It's seen from out here, everything seems different. Time bends. Space is boundless. It squashes a man's ego. I feel lonely.
That's about it.
Tell me, though. Does man, that marvel of the universe, that glorious paradox who sent me to the stars, still make war against his brother? Keep his neighbor's children starving?
It's funny. You know, how many post-apocalyptic movies did that guy star in?
A lot. Yeah, a lot.
Kind of strange when you think about it. But and he was older at the time, and Brian, who does not have a shame gene.
it's a very rare medical condition. It's called ashamia. Yes.
Exactly. So we went up to Mr. Heston, and you know, and I'm generally an autograph guy by my nature, and so that we went up there when we asked him for one, because it was kind of our house. He was coming to visit, and he just shut us down. He's like, "No, I don't do that." And we're sort of, and he walked away. You know, big guy, taller than me, and he's like, "There goes Charlton Heston," and you know, he just dissed us.
Because Brian isn't here to defend himself, I'm at least going to quote him and illustrate it. Brian came. He was dejected, heartbroken, and he said, "We asked him, you know," and he slapped his hand on my shoulder and said, "I'm sorry, son. I don't do that." And then he walked away like Dr. Zaius. That's how he described it.
I'm like, well, I was gonna leave out the Dr. Zaius.
I know you were, but I'm saying, and if he's not here, ashamia. For $15 a day, you can save a child like Brian and teach him to not say what pops into his head.
That's right. Exactly. To use an in-head voice and out-of-head voice.
That was a very good one.
Yeah, that was funny as hell. But hey, now we have to make a turn back to Columbia. Another, you know, working at Fox, there was a lot of ups and downs over the years, and certainly one came on a Saturday morning in 2003, and I was asleep at my desk. No, I was home. And Jackie, my wife, woke me up, and she said, "I've got terrible news," and Columbia had exploded. And of course, my pager was starting to go off, and maybe I had a cell phone then, I don't know. But that, to me, it almost was more upsetting than Challenger, you know, which was a shock of its own when I was 16, watching Challenger explode from the other side of a counter at a deli I used to go to on Prospect Park Southwest called Sal's. And I used to watch all of the space, all of the launches. And so I knew immediately that something terrible had happened. But, you know, move ahead to 2003, and then this terribly sad news about Columbia, and you think about, of course, just the people in there, and you think about their loved ones, and you think about what it does to part of our national fabric. You know, this is 2 years after 9/11, and I continue to hold the space program as something positive, and just what a terrible, terribly sad day. And of course, we all went into work and did what you do, and you know, went wall to wall for the day, and then we all went to Rosie's afterwards and raised more than a few glasses to the crew of that doomed orbiter. But before we move out of this segment, you know, talk about Trek, and you talk about this being risk averse, and here's a great soundbite from Kirk talking to his inner circle about some tough choices that need to be made. And this, for me, and I think a lot of other people, says it all, especially when, you know, this is at the dawn of the Apollo era. Give a listen.
They used to say if a man could fly, he'd have wings. But he did fly. He discovered he had to. Do you wish that the first Apollo mission hadn't reached the moon, or that we hadn't gone on to Mars and then to the nearest star? That's like saying you wish that you still operated with scalpels and sewed your patients up with catgut, like your great-great-great-great-grandfather used to. I'm in command. I could order this. But I'm not. Because Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great. Risk is our business. That's what this starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her. You may descend without prejudice. Do I hear A negative vote. Engineer, stand by to beam aboard three receptacles.
Ah, Jim Kirk, thank you. I would follow you to the barrier at the edge of the galaxy. You're awesome.
I would follow him to the Antares Nebula around Perdition's flame before I give him up.
Oh, I love that movie.
And I popped the P on purpose there because that's, you know,
of course,
that's real good radio.
It's Montalban, exactly. Speaking of really good radio, one of my favorite radio shows was Car Talk on NPR, and stopped producing episodes in 2012, but the repeats are still really popular. And Tom Magliozzi, he was one half of the Car Talk team. He died Monday of complications from Alzheimer's. He was 77. With his brother Ray, they were Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. And since 87, they broadcast to a national audience at NPR. It was just good, good radio. It was a lot of fun.
Tom had this booming, infectious laugh, and the show was always a good time. The nature of their relationship fueled the whole thing. They'd tell jokes, give some car advice in there, and generally just have a great time. The brothers had an everyman style and did have a car repair shop in real life. They were also, the both of them, graduates from MIT.
Yeah, and we wanted to give Tom some love and came across this clip, which fits with today's show. Give a listen.
This next caller, this guy, you'd have to say was definitely out there. I mean, that would be a good way to describe him. Would you say?
Oh, yeah. He was out there, all right. And it took us a while, but we eventually, even us.
It did take us a while, though. It's stupid.
We eventually caught on. Seven, hello, you're on Car Talk.
Hello, Tom, Ray. It's great to talk to you. This is John from Houston.
Hi, John.
John, we can barely hear you.
Okay, I'll speak up a little bit.
Oh, that's good.
I work for the government, so I can't tell you too much, but I occasionally drive this government vehicle. It's one of those Rockwell things.
Uh-huh.
And twice it's done a very funny thing, and I thought maybe you guys could help me with it.
What Rockwell thing?
You know, one of those Rockwell vans.
A van?
Anyway, the twice that I've driven this thing off the line when I first started up, it starts great. Accelerates really, really well.
Yeah.
And it runs incredibly rough, though, for about 2 minutes. This is one of those puzzlers.
Yeah. Rough for 2 minutes.
After the first 2 minutes, after this really rough ride, there's kind of a jolt, and then it runs smooth, but only for about 6.5 more minutes. And then at that point, the engine dies.
The engine dies?
Yeah, it just stops completely.
Gee, you know, I hate to make any...
two different vehicles by serial number, and both have done exactly the same thing.
Well, these vehicles have serial numbers.
Well,
different vehicles.
I hate to be suspicious.
I'm suspicious also.
I hate to be suspicious, but the whole what would I call it? The sound coming from the telephone.
Yeah.
Sounds so familiar. I mean, I expect you to say
I'm on the cellular.
Yeah, you sound like Tom Hanks saying, "Houston, we have a problem." Where are you calling from, John?
Just a second. Let me look. I'm about 200 miles north of Hawaii.
No! Really? No kidding. How did they fish you into this deal?
Well, this is a good deal. In fact, I'm in the vehicle as we speak.
And it's probably running really quiet right now, huh?
Yeah, it's running pretty quiet, I'd say. We're still going pretty fast, but it's very quiet.
How fast are you going?
Oh, about 17,500 miles an hour.
Boy, this thing must have some brakes, huh?
This must be a Dodge Dart.
I just love it. It's just, you know, they were, first of all, the astronaut, John Grunsfeld, it was just great that he called in. And to have them finally sort of dawn on them and get it was just such a treat, you know. And these guys, they rolled with it, and it was just such a fun, cool segment that I think really just encapsulates what was so great about these guys.
Yeah, that was shuttle mission STS-81. The mission was the fifth docking with the Mir space station. And that's a chance also for a shout out to the Buran, which was the Soviet space shuttle. Mm-hmm. Never flew into space. It did fly. Buran means snowstorm. And because they used a lot of open source stuff and they sort of tried to improve on the American design because the military in the Soviet Union, specifically Brezhnev, was terrified that this space shuttle was going to be used to just drop from orbit into Moscow and drop a nuke on it. And right. So they raced to try to build one. But because they were building so parallel, they had the same connector. So if you went up to the Mir, this is why the space shuttle was able to connect to it. Because when you think about it, why would we have the same connector? You can't even go and plug your microphone into a plug in the Soviet Union at this point. It's different. It's different amperage and everything.
But that's right.
Because they were doing this so much at the same time, we were able to just hook up, and that helped later with things like the International Space Station for us to all fly up there and build that. And so that was one of those benefits you talked about, advancing humanity forward.
That's the thing about advancing humanity forward through the space program. It's, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we have so many problems here on Earth and poverty and war and all that, and we should maybe be using our money for other things. And I think we waste a lot. We waste enough money, you know, across the board, that to say that, you know, we don't have room for space is just, it's an ignorant argument, and it's such a short-sighted thought process. We need space. We need to want to go to space. We need to want to explore. You know, it's manifest destiny, man. That galaxy is ours. Let's take it. You know,
yeah. There's plenty of things too. You can't always point to them, but certainly something like private space exploration. Obviously, that's gonna have benefits to it because it's an economic engine. It's a recreational outlet. It's something exciting, but it doesn't necessarily have to be about space. You know, you look at how many doctors DeForest Kelly always said went up to him and told him that because you were a doctor in Star Trek, I wanted to be a doctor. And one of the things about the space program was also that President Kennedy wanted more people to get involved in science. And I think there was a much more, I don't know what you would call it, intense connection to the president. Today they all do those kind of things, and the First Lady does them, and they get very lost in the buzz of modern times. But that these things really do propel you forward, and they are things you can use here on Earth, because you never know. You could go into it wanting to go into space. There are plenty of people in the Air Force that want to go into space. A friend of mine in the Army volunteered to go there, and you know, it just gives you, like you said, something to strive for. A man's reach to exceed his grasp. And so I think just to look at it as, well, we got Tang, I guess, and
Tang, gang. It's Tang-terrific.
Tang, the instant breakfast drink with new natural orange flavor.
Hurry, folks, step right up, shoot a duck, and win a jar of natural orange flavor Tang. It's the new improved Tang that tastes better than ever.
Boy, I like instant Tang, but I hate the idea of shooting a relative.
Just shoot one little duck, Duck, and get this big jar of Tang.
Tang? Goodbye, Auntie.
You missed, but you can't miss with Tang. And if you really want Tang at its best, make up a pitcherful and cool it off in the refrigerator overnight. Great for breakfast or any thirsty old time.
That's Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, of course, selling Tang on a TV commercial in the early 60s. That had to make you love Tang. Astronauts and Looney Tunes drank it.
I do like Tang.
I could go for some Tang now. I'm going to have to go get it.
So can I.
Yeah, delicious Tang.
Tang.
Tang is for Earthmen who just don't want to be Earthbound. Drink Tang and go. Tang, the energy breakfast drink for Earthmen.
We should note that Tang was invented by General Foods in 1959. Not by the government, not by NASA, a common misconception. The myth started when John Glenn did indeed bring Tang aboard his Mercury flight in 1962. That's when Tang really took off, so to speak. But full disclosure, we know today that not all of our astronauts loved Tang. Buzz Aldrin, second man on the moon, declared just 2 years ago, quote, "Tang sucks."
This goes to that point we were talking about earlier. First of all, here, let's just throw one of these wacky space sounds out. This is Saturn radio waves. Give a listen. Yeah, that is like, you know, somebody's Cold War space ghost nightmare coming at them. I love that sound. One of the things that, you know, of course, Star Trek gave us also in the high adventure was, you know, for guys like me and Dean, and I'm going to venture a guess, a lot of you folks at home or in the car sitting in traffic. I'm sorry if you're in traffic right now, but hey, at least you got us, right?
Yeah, well, we heard recently, actually, not to jump in on another subject, but some guys from Sydney, the What a Pair of Trousers podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hi, guys.
Yeah, Stu, I believe it is, from the Angry Chimp podcast, no relation. And and he said that he spends a lot of time sitting in traffic there in Sydney, and we're one of the shows that he listens to. And I just thought, well, what a cool thing, you know? I mean, that's the space exploration right there. If we didn't have satellites up there, we weren't able to put them there, we wouldn't be able to bounce our voices all the way to Sydney. Now, granted, bringing us to places like Sydney and Japan and South America and wherever you happen to be listening may not sound like a wise investment of your tax dollars, but I would disagree.
Yeah, so would I. I'm with you 100%.
Thank you.
Sure. I like your style, Dean. I like your style. I'm going to stick with you for a while.
I think so.
Could do worse. But, you know, one of the great things about Trek 2 was, you know, well, was this sound, for example. What was that? Now, awesome, right? Fantastic. Great laser sound, phaser sound. I said that laser for the lay people at home. But great phaser sound. Hitting up against a deflector shield in space. Never happened. No oxygen. Here's another one. TIE Fighter. We love this one. Yeah! Right? One of the most recognizable bits of sci-fi audio ever. But here's Star Wars and here's Star Trek as directed by Stanley Kubrick. Okay, maybe not as exciting from an audio perspective, but accurate. The man, you know, he went for it. You know, it's kind of cool. You would have these shows later on. I think like Battlestar Galactica had they took a sort of compromise approach to sound in space. I think they would have audio for certain things and not others. And maybe they would like the closer you got to the atmosphere, you know, then maybe some sound would creep in.
Yeah, they made a compromise. They said we're only going to use one or two sounds, but we're going to reuse them over and over every.
I meant the new Galactica, the more recent one, the Galactica that was awesome, the Galactica that was in contention to be the top three sci-fi shows of all time until it went so horrifyingly off the rails that I don't even want to think about it much anymore. But of course, I'm going to stop the show and I'm going to sit and listen to this all day long.
Mars One will establish human settlement on Mars in 2023. In that year, the first group of four humans will land on Mars. Every 2 years after that, another group will join the settlement.
I was reading about this idea of taking a one-way trip to Mars, Mars One. They want to start in 2024, which is not that far away as it sounds.
No.
That's only 10 years away. And how many people would want to go and do that? Well, as of May, the company that wants to do this had 200,000 signups to go for a one-way trip and start to colonize Mars. Now, granted, the technology's not there. Granted, probably 90% of those people will freak out or not be physically able to go to Mars. But there's something to be said for so many people just filling out the application and wanting to throw their name on the list of people that could potentially go to this new world and never come back again.
Yeah.
And I think that all those things that we study, you know, things like cryosleep, things like, which is a real thing now, not just science fiction.
Right.
You know, people don't get science fiction, they don't get space, but a lot of this stuff does definitely pay dividends later for people right here on Earth. And even if it's just a dream, even if it's just, you know, hey, maybe your life's not going anywhere and you think, well, maybe someday I could be, you know, like Zefram Cochrane was in those movies as a fictional person, or like,
right,
you know, Ulysses S. Grant, who washed out of everything that he ever tried and yet ended up winning the Civil War and becoming president. People need something sometimes just to give them that push.
That's
to
right.
Make them want to study. And, you know, it's too bad that that these guys are not the heroes, that space travel, as we saw in Apollo 13, where they didn't cover that on TV live.
No.
Because it becomes a little bit pedestrian, and I think sci-fi sort of stole some of the thunder from things like going to Mars, because we want the Orion slave girls, and we want the cantina, and
yeah,
we want
exactly.
All the things we were promised, and just to go there, and I think it's important, because we get distracted by so many visual things nowadays, so many virtual, rather, things, you know, and visual, TV, video games, all this stuff. Science is real and concrete, and Mars is real and concrete, and there's a reason to go there.
It's right next door. I mean, not to make it sound too easy. Going to go get some milk.
Galactically speaking.
Exactly. But this one-way trip notion is fascinating, that at least, like you said, as far as filling out the application, you have people who are willing to die. But we had explorers who were willing to die and who knew that they would not be coming home. And they did it in the furtherance of life on this planet, or at least under some country's flag. So, fascinating stuff. We'll see how that works out. I frankly would like to come back, but you know, we'll see.
You got your stuff.
Yeah, I got my stuff. It's like,
well, I think what they do is they put all your. I mean, I can't even say this anymore because it makes no sense. I was gonna say put all your DVDs, and I guess I'll have to say they don't have those. Yeah. I guess they put all your action figures in a rocket first,
right?
You know, and they ship those. They shoot those to Mars, and then they land you right by it, so you have a little model of the Enterprise. And
exactly.
Whatnot.
Or my first edition, Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Well, I want you to know that when I go and colonize Mars, Mars, you are more than welcome at the William McKinley's, you know, city, which is going to be the capital of Mars. Yeah, we couldn't get let a whole episode go by without mentioning McKinley or Winston Churchill or Theodore Roosevelt.
There you go. How about Woodrow Wilson? Are you sorry? Are you going to spearhead them renaming an indigenously named mountain on Mars to McKinley?
No, I don't think that there would be any point to that.
No? Okay. You sure?
No.
Okay.
I mean, because the whole planet's going to already be renamed.
Right. McKinley 1. Planet McKinley 1.
They don't have a moon to name. Well, build one.
Build one. That's not a moon. It's a space station. It's funny, you know, just as humanity has barely moved from its home world, we barely touched the notion of space travel and what it means for the U.S. and the rest of the planet. And we're going to get my uncle on soon to continue this discussion. Miguel San Martin is a rocket scientist. He's a genuine rocket scientist. He has an incredibly boring job. He pilots spacecrafts and lands them on Mars so the rovers that are within can go roll around the red planet. That's what he does for a living. That's what my uncle does for a living.
Oh, gosh. Boring. Boring.
Here's a bit of T.O. talking about what he does. And this is from a great, great video produced for Jet Propulsion Labs in the run-up to the August 2012 landing of Curiosity on Mars. Give a listen to my uncle.
During entry, the vehicle is not only slowing down violently through the atmosphere, but also we are guiding it like an airplane to be able to land in a very narrow constrained space. This is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing, and one that we had never attempted on Mars.
Man, oh man, did they land it. Here are the moments when they knew that they had accomplished their mission. Give a listen.
We are in powered flight. We're at altitude of 1 kilometer descending, about 70 meters per second.
Signal to us, you remain air.
Down to 50 meters per second. 500 meters in altitude. Standing by for Sky Crane. Constant velocity accordion nominal. Altitude error 5.9 meters. We found a nice flat place. We're coming in ready for Sky Crane. Down to 10 meters per second. 40 meters altitude. Sky Crane has started. Descending at about 0.75 meters per second as expected. Expecting bridle cut shortly.
Tango to us, you remain strong.
Tango Delta nominal.
Yeah, you do a calm configure.
Rim is stable. Rim is stable.
UHF is good. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
Yeah, and if you look, if you go Google Miguel San Martin and Curiosity and do an image search, you'll see there's just, I get chills every time I look at them. My uncle is so happy. He's ecstatic. He's got tears running down his face. He's got an American flag in each hand. And everyone is just hardcore celebrating what was an incredibly difficult task. Again, one of these things that you do not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And so we're gonna get my uncle on next month or so to come and talk to us about all this stuff, which is gonna be pretty exciting.
Great, we'll look forward to it.
Yeah. In the meantime, this was just us wanting to talk a bit about some space things and things that were on our minds and a couple things that had been in the news. And obviously, it's great to be back with you guys. It's been a little insanely busy at our end, and you know, we're gonna be at a normalized schedule soon, we promise you. But you know, we're here, and we love being with you guys and talking about the things we love to talk about. So thanks so much for joining us.
And we will see you somewhere out there.
Second star to the right. Straight on till morning. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Carianis.
We'll see you guys next time. Take care.
Space, the final frontier.
Now it is time to take longer strides.
These are the voyages
time
of
for a great new American enterprise. Time
it's
for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which
life,
in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
I believe we possess all the resources and talents necessary. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space. And none will be so difficult are expensive to accomplish.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Space is disease and danger wrapped in darkness and silence.